Hit it.
Welcome to the Test Talks Podcast, the place to go to geek out on software testing. And now your host, whose mission is to help you succeed with test automation, Joe Colantonio.
Hello, 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 and welcome to another episode of Test Talks, a podcast dedicated to all things test automation. I'm your host, Joe, from joecolantonio.com, and my mission is to help you succeed with test automation awesomeness. And in today's episode, we'll be speaking with Greg Pascal about his new article, Removing the Word Test from Test Automation. So I have a question for you. Are you harnessing the full power of automation? There are many instances where automation can assist us in saving time with many things that you may not be aware of. Greg shares with us 5 underutilized areas where automation can help. Get the most out of your automation efforts with Greg's tips. This episode will help you find hidden opportunities to unleash your automation awesomeness. Check it out. But before we do, I just want to give a shout out to 7H3M, I assume that's an alias, for their review of Test Talks in iTunes. Thank you so much. Reviews are really appreciated because they really do help the show and its rankings within iTunes. And it's easy to do. All you need to do is head on over to iTunes, type in Test Talks, then click on the Ratings and Review tab. If you don't have time to write a review, just go ahead and give us a 5-star rating. If you do leave a review, I'll give you a shout out in an upcoming episode. So let's jump into our call with Greg. Greg Pascal is the author of multiple white papers on test automation and testing in general. He has spoken at pretty much all the big conferences, including Star East, Star West, QAI, and QA Trailblazers. Greg is well known in the testing industry as being passionate about mentoring and training others in software testing, and that really shines through within this episode. Hey, Greg, welcome back to Test Talks.
Hey, Joe, thanks for having me again.
So, Greg is our second repeat guest on Test Talks, and after you listen to this episode, be sure to check him out also in episode 8, where we talked about some really helpful tips on how to implement test automation. So, Greg, what have you been up to since last time we spoke?
Oh, just working on this latest article. I've actually got a third in the works as well, that hopefully will be out here in a few months. But overall, just a little bit of vacation time. 25th anniversary with my bride, and so just kind of enjoying the tail end of the summer here.
Congratulations, 25 years, that's awesome.
Yeah, thanks.
So today I would like to talk about your latest article on Sticky Minds, Removing the Word Test from Test Automation. Why did you feel like you had to write this article?
Because oftentimes I find that organizations that are going to get into automation, or in many cases have been in it for a number of years, they don't step back sometimes to consider, what does this tool actually allow us to do? They really get kind of a narrow focus on, you know, have test cases, must automate. And this is really an opportunity to speak to that, to say, you've invested this money, this time, this training to get this tool. Here's some things to really consider that give you a great opportunity for really additional benefit.
And I know you covered 5 main areas in this article. I believe there are automated transaction entry, automated data validation, automated environment validation and configuration, automated system monitoring, and automated data preparation and setup. I'd like to go through each one just to get your view on how automation can help with each one and maybe get some examples.
Sounds great.
So the first one, automated transaction entry. How can automation help us with transaction entry?
Well, this is kind of what got the whole ball rolling for me, and I talk a little bit about that in this article. So oftentimes, when someone asks us to automate, they'll have a regression case, test case, or a suite of test cases to automate, and we know we're going to go through that process of validating along the way. Well, in this particular case that kind of started this whole idea of removing the word test from test automation, I encountered a situation that came out of development where they were moving new code into the dev environment and they needed test data. They basically needed test transactions in there. And due to the nature of the technology in place, it was a little bit of a legacy technology. They didn't have an easy way of doing it. I knew I was working with a junior automation engineer at the time, training and mentoring her. I thought about this idea of having her start to build some basic automation that would just put a transaction through. And that's exactly what we did. I think we probably spent a couple weeks building that tool out, if you will. And it became a big hit for the development team as far as seeding the environment with data. And that kind of got the whole thing going. My manager at the time was thrilled that we had considered new ways of using the tool to really get, as you know, these tools can be very expensive, to get some added value out of them. So this was a great example of that, where we were able to seed these transactions in manually. It was so brutal. It would take a team days to prep this data, and now we could run it, you know, in probably 20 to 30 minutes.
Awesome. I actually have a great example of how this helped me in my previous job. I worked for an insurance company, and basically we had business users that would go in and create a policy. And in this policy, they would add like 50 tractors, you know, 20 cars, 50 farms, you know, all these types of things that they would help them rate a policy. And then they'd change the state to rate it to see, to make sure that the differences came up with what the new changes were that they added to the system. So they spent most of their time just manually entering all this data just to get it to a point where they could rate it. And so what we did is we created an automated test that would populate, basically would read from a spreadsheet all the data that they wanted to add for each policy. And once the test went in and automatically entered all the different types of coverages, they then were able to go in and rate it, and it saved them a bunch of time. So I definitely agree with you. Transaction entry is a huge benefit that I think a lot of people are missing out. So can we go over then the next point you have about data validation? How could it help us with data validation?
Sure. Well, this was another one of those real-world scenarios. We had a dashboard, and it was a really complex dashboard that allowed the customer to drill in at a very granular level to analyze performance metrics related to products at a retail company. And as you can imagine, with that much data, the manual testing team could nowhere come close to validating it all. I at one time calculated the total number of values. I think, believe it or not, this single web page, if you were actually to expand all the possibilities and drill into it, contained almost 10,000 validation points. Again, a human, even on their best day, is not going to be able to accurately validate that kind of data. So nonetheless, we were able to automate this process. The automation could go through it. It was a pretty timely process, believe it or not, still, because there was a UI involved. It was web-based. It still had to collapse and expand aspects to get to the data. But it could finish it in about 45 minutes. And again, the project was excited for a lot of reasons. One is they finally got some coverage across it, and you know, they could get their manual folks onto other more important things. And believe it or not, we found all sorts of defects in the data once we did that were just buried in the depths of a mound of data. So it was just a great win all in all, and it just emphasized this idea that these tools have so much more potential.
I'm just surprised that it actually found issues. A lot of times you do a lot of validation tests and doesn't necessarily find issues. So you actually found in your experience that it did find legitimate bugs?
We did, and it was fantastic because we had a big review with our senior management, and they actually made reference to this tool and its ability to really dig into a very granular level, all the nitty-gritty, you know, edges of the data, and found some things.
Besides transaction entry and data validation, the third point you made is environment validation and configuration. What do you mean by that?
So I love that you asked about going through this one. This is kind of twofold, but just recently I had such a fantastic win in this area. I actually made a note. I call this the free money item out of it, because if people will apply this, I think they're going to get a significant value. And this is how I found to use this automated environment validation. So us as QA folks, we receive a build and we're told, go ahead and perform your test cases, you know, go do some exploratory testing, whatever it is. We're given a build, and however often your release cycle is, you know, you take for granted a few things, that the environment is set up properly, you know, the various moving parts are working. A lot of systems we all work on have databases, they might have web services, they might have a number of technologies that all have to be in place for it to work. And that's exactly the case in this project that I recently encountered. So to manually go through it again was kind of like our previous example. It was just so intensive that it couldn't really be done quickly, and it was hard to say it could be done accurately because of the nitty-gritty details of things that it had to find. So in this case, we actually didn't necessarily use our HP tool set. We used another automated process, but we were able to validate things like, and I'll actually give you an example. We were validating that certain config files existed, And believe it or not, we actually verify that certain directory structures contained a certain number of folders and files below them. And we used it kind of as a test just to say, generally speaking, everything looks like it's in place before we engage the manual testers to begin testing. And that turned out to be a huge win because guess how often we found things misconfigured? When we had to turn our technology folks in configuring this whole system, there was just so many moving parts. So it wasn't impossible for somebody to get distracted for a minute and forget to move a file in or all sorts of things that could come into place. And we're actually hoping to enhance this method to actually look inside of files as well and check for certain switch settings and that sort of thing. So this is something still evolving, but it's turning out to provide a huge win for our team. We built even a little dashboard that shows the end results in a little HTML file at the end, and so that it could be accessed anywhere, and the QA testers could say, the environment's ready for me to go in and test.
I really like this particular point you brought up. I'm also thinking it could be used in a continuous integration environment. For example, this happens to me all the time. Mm-hmm. We have tests that run in a CI environment. So it's our int branch. It's our main branch. So we'll run the test against our environment. Mm-hmm. But what's happening is before that, we have 7-8 Scrum teams that down-merge the code into their own little environments, the dev branches. And they change a config file to say localhost. Huh. And then invariably, one of these knuckleheads will check this in to the CI, and CI will run, and it'll try running against localhost. So I'm curious to know what you think. Would it be a good idea, in your opinion, to create, say, a Python script that goes in, first thing it checks is say, or first thing it does, it automatically overwrites that file with the correct IP address? Is that one of the uses that you would think of for environment validation and configuration?
It's a great use of it, Joe. We actually used a language called Lua. But the same concept, you could do it with Python. You could probably pull this off in VBScript without too much trouble. But the idea is let that script do the work of things. And as you know, these scripts can also produce some pretty simple outputs. So take advantage of that as well. And for the folks rolling it downstream, they can use it for other purposes as well. But we have found a great win in this area for sure.
Yeah, another one that comes to mind is you can almost use it like a pre-launch sequence to. So you had a test suite that takes 2 hours to run, that if you can catch these issues within the first 2 minutes, usually these scripts are headless, they must run fairly quickly.
Yep.
You can get feedback right away to say, hey, wait a minute, there's an issue. Before you leave for the night, fix this because your tests are going to fail. So it could possibly save you a lot of time also.
And think about the scope of folks that get to use this. I mean, it's beyond even just the QA folks. This really becomes a great tool for anybody that wants to ensure the environment's in good shape before we move forward. So, yeah, I'm hopeful other folks will grab this concept. You can do it with your automation tools as well, but you can write this and fulfill this with a lot of different technologies.
I also think this kind of is the same as this next point you brought up, but I'm curious to get your insight into it. Automated system monitoring. How could automation help us with system monitoring?
So actually, this one came out of the item we just talked about. There is a particular group that monitors production systems, and it came to mind that they could actually, if, as you and I both know, Joe, there are so many folks that have bought these HP tool sets or other tool sets, and they wound up becoming shelfware. And it's very unfortunate, especially when you consider how expensive they are. I actually kind of thought about that particular person in mind who knows they've bought this tool and they're just not sure where's a good place to use it. Here's another opportunity. Just put that tool out there just to go ping things, to go check things are in the right place, that a system is online. I mean, you could literally just hit a website, make sure it's displaying properly. It's very unconventional, I would say. But it is a good opportunity to leverage these tools, and I'm hoping we're going to move in that in some of the work I'm doing. It got brought up, and I thought, hey, maybe there's an opportunity here to do something very similar as we're doing the same with the environment validation.
I know HP has a tool called SiteScope, and I believe another tool used to be called Business Availability. Mm-hmm. And basically, you would use scripts to monitor systems to check the CPU utilization, and if a machine's down, it would ping a machine to make sure it was up and running. And if it wasn't up and running, it would send an alert to be proactive. So these are the types of things you could possibly do with system monitoring, correct?
I agree. This really takes a different way of thinking. And I love to encourage automation engineers to step back and really think about, what do I really have in my hand here? What does this tool really enable me to do? I can I can already hear people saying, why, you bought this expensive tool just to ping this. The reality is a lot of us own this tool and we're not doing nothing with it. So this is a way of squeezing just a little bit more out of it, a little bit more out of it. These tools are very capable of tasks like this, and they're very easy to set up. Let's say you just needed to set the thing up over a weekend and text you or email you if something went down real quick and dirty. So there are some very simple ways that they can be leveraged in this way.
And I would think almost that these things are almost better suited for automation. It's the kind of thoughtless kind of things that you can automate and have peace of mind to know it's being checked, but it doesn't really require, you know, a human being to actually go in and do some sort of analysis.
You bring up a great point here, and it follows well into my next point. And I tell folks this a lot of times when they're jumping into automation, when they buy a tool, inevitably, the first thing they're told is, here's the regression suite, go automate everything, which is absolutely the worst thing you could probably go ahead and start doing, because you need to learn how the methodology of the tool and a bunch of other things. You're going to probably waste a lot of time by approaching it like that. But if you look at what the tool is capable of and you start with these small tasks that you can replicate, something I tell our manual testers, look for that thing you have to repeat, 100 times, but it's just 4 or 5 steps. Let our automation engineer know about that and see if he can help resolve that process. That's a great place to jump in with automation. It lets the automation engineer get familiar with the tool set and know what it does well and what it doesn't do real well. And then they can expand it from there. But that, unfortunately, is not the case in most situations.
Let's touch upon your very last point then, is automated data preparation and setup.
Yeah, this is a really great opportunity to, again, we're not validating anything. We're essentially taking our automation tool and seeding it with certain sets of parameters and then letting it generate data. Most of these tools work really well with Microsoft Excel or spreadsheets, or it could export a tab delimited file or something that can be moved in as a data sheet for our other purposes. So why not let it do it? We're creating simple loops here that are concatenating data together and generating this sort of test data. So I think it's another great opportunity for data prep, and it was worth mentioning here as well.
So this article you wrote actually got me thinking about other things. I saw a talk recently on CAST by Richard Bradshaw about automation, how basically he was talking about how he doesn't like the term test automation and how he's saying it's not really testing. And so I just want to get your thoughts on that, because basically he flipped it around to say, so rather than saying test automation, saying automation in testing. So just by flipping it around, saying it's to support testing, it is not necessarily testing. He actually calls it checking, that it's just checking. It can't really do testing because testing requires a human being that's able to think. So I think that your points you bring up are excellent, because these are actually the areas that I think he would agree with, that this is a perfect place for automation. Have you seen that talk? Have you heard anything about that?
I haven't seen that talk, but it sounds like we're of a very similar mindset. I definitely hear where he's coming from. I try to help folks realize this when I encounter them, that the way these tools are sold versus how they work in the real world, unfortunately, there's a great chasm there. And so we start off right out of the gate as automation engineers with unrealistic expectations, almost in every case. And feel for the guys that have to try to perform the miracle, as I call it, because we all have been down that road where we're told to, automate an entire regression set or suite or some huge amount of thing, and we begin to work on it for the next year. And all along, no one's really considered the maintainability or sustainability along the way. I think you and I talked about that in the last podcast we did. This is the area that really gets folks. I really tell them, when it comes to automation, you don't really have anything until you've used it, a year or two down the road, and it still works. It's scaling well. You're able to maintain it. Writing it the first go around and getting it running is a big effort, but that's really not the finish line. It's really just the starting line of getting value, and measuring the ROI gets real tricky. I heard one HP often promotes 2 to 3, maybe 4 cycles of an automation suite when you use their BPT methodology. That's, again, I don't think that's realistic. I would say you're looking at much further down the road, maybe 8 or 10 cycles of it before you really see it. And I'm a big fan, too, of trying to keep my automation efforts down to a couple weeks. Again, you can see you could never really finish a regression suite in that amount of time. But you can do these short little tasks in that amount of time. You may have a bigger project, but I like to shoot for those couple week windows because what you can develop in a couple weeks gives you time to try it out and say, hey, this is a great win. Let's keep doing things like this. Just like the article you're talking about, it augments what the manual testers are doing. It assists them in those things that are tough to get done.
Awesome. Yeah. And I really like how you just emphasize that it doesn't replace manual testing. It assists manual testers to help get their job done. So I think that's a great point. Hopefully that message will get out more because I think we talked in the past that a lot of times you go into organizations or you speak to managers and they say 100% automation and it's completely unrealistic and it's not meant to replace a manual tester. It's meant to assist or support testing.
Yeah, and it sets an unrealistic expectation that somehow that automation tool even comes close to being what a human can do. And that's just crazy. You and I both know, you know, the text could be completely upside down on a page and in some foreign language, but the piece you're validating is accurate. And it would say pass, you know, it would move right along. And so it isn't as smart as I think a lot of folks make it out to be. And so this idea of using it to assist us is really where you get great win, but it's a tough sell sometimes when someone just plunked down a huge sum of money to get these tools. They've hired folks to come in. Well, we could do a whole nother article on hiring good automation folks because it's very tough to do. There's a lot of folks, since there's no real school of test automation, that have learned methodologies that don't scale well and don't have a lot of repeatability to them. Okay, Joe, well, I want to share with you something I've been exploring in the last year. It came out of, I'll call it a best practice, grown over a couple years of real-world automation experience. But I got to really apply it over the last 12 months with my current team. And what I love to do is spend time with our manual test engineers, learn about, you know, kind of what's their day look like, what's eating their lunch, the things that what they love about what they do, what's tough, and try to find some areas where I can assist with the tools that we write and the tools that we work in. And I eventually coined the term auto-op or automation opportunity out of this. And I like to use that two-week time frame I was telling you about. So when I sit with them and I hear what they're doing, I'm thinking, what could I build in a week or two that could really assist in this area that's really tough for this person? And in our case, we'll wind up storing these auto-op ideas in a wiki, but I would suggest you centralize them somewhere if you're going to apply a similar process. And you begin to identify, okay, I need a tool that can query this, or I need a tool that can set up data like this, or I need, you know, whatever it might be, something that can validate my environment or query this database to make sure this is in such a state. And the auto-ops execution doesn't have to happen in a QTP or Selenium. It just is something that an automation engineer is probably more wired to do. He's a coder and a programmer, and he's able to pull these things together as short utilities, small little utilities. Think of it as you do with your phone. In my iPhone, I have all these apps, and typically those apps, as an app developer too, by the way, shameless plug there, most apps are designed to be used within about 60 seconds. You're meant to kind of jump in them, get what you need, and leave. And so these auto ops are the same idea. It's something that a tester needs real quick. They need to do with it, and then they get out. And we've taken this so far as actually replicated the look of an iPhone sort of feel in a small dashboard that comes up on our manual tester screen. It's literally about 3 inches by 3 inches block, and we built icons that have a similar look and feel to an iPhone icon, and we have pages you flip back and forth. And these little auto ops are just real handy for that automation engineer or that manual test engineer to get access to just by selecting them and going to it. It performs what it needs and they leave.
Oh, really cool. How does it perform when you click on it?
Most of them either are talking to some back-end database and querying data. So we might request a little bit of data. We've built one that's very useful in gathering log files for the developers when we find a defect. It pulls a specific group of log files together, zips them up, names it in a specific time stamp format and gets it ready so we can attach it to the defect in our issue tracking software. We've got a variety of them that will do things like this, querying, like I said, databases and other things.
What's the dashboard? What's that written in?
It's just written in a little HTML file. So it's served off of our IIS server in-house. And we actually set up a DNS entry, so it's very easy for people to get to. They just type in a QA Launchpad, and it pops right up there in the corner, and it's ready for them to go. It's a very, very useful tool.
Great idea. So, Greg, before we go, can you give us any hints to what your next article is going to be about? Give the people a little teaser.
A little teaser, yeah. Let me go over some other ones I'm hoping to write. I'm not going to cover this one too much, Joe, yet. I've got some more to do on it.
Sure.
One of the articles I'm excited about writing pretty soon down the road here is something around what I'm calling the art and soul of a function library. I'm excited to share a little bit of around that strategy because I've seen so often how folks, they usually have to come up with some way they're going to organize it. But I've seen, you know, some projects that have dozens of function libraries and each library holds one function. I've seen monstrous function libraries that hold the whole enchilada. And when it comes to writing that article and sharing on that down the road here, I want to help folks consider how they will organize a good function library strategy and how they need to begin to think about building out a core function library that's application agnostic. And to me, this is the tricks of their trade. It's something they'll invest in for years to come and really build out and become bold and strong. And it's really worth building out great functions in that function library. And they'll be able to use it all over the place. So that's one I've got on the books here to write not too far down the road.
Awesome. Yeah, I think that'd be really helpful. I work in Java with Selenium, and a lot of the teams will write some generic code, but they'll place it in a really obscure function library or method that doesn't make any sense.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, pull that out, give it a more generic name, and then other teams then can access it. They'll be able to utilize it rather than it being hidden in a place that doesn't even make sense. So I think that's going to be really helpful.
Yeah, it seems like coming up with a good strategy for naming conventions, function library order. Boy, we could write a whole article in this space on object recognition. I call it the art of what we do as automation engineers. It really is one of those things that takes a finesse. And I hate to say it, not everybody has it, but the more you can understand your technology, the better you get at object recognition, whether you're working in HTML or, you know, Java or some other technology. Getting to become an expert in the way objects are created really gives you a huge advantage in your automation.
So one other point I forgot to ask about, are there any tools or scripting language that you do use to help you implement the five different automation strategies you laid out in your article?
The most common tools I use, because they're used by my tool set, is VBScript. But I'd be lying to you to tell you, I love JavaScript as well. You'll actually find a bunch of JavaScript games I've written online. And I'm a big HTML nut as well. And I just was introduced to the Lua language recently. And so I'm actually working and creating some tools in Lua. But one of the fun things I love to do is get these tools to actually generate other types of code. And the most common of that code is HTML. I like it because when I want to log things as an output, why not log it in an HTML format that I can bring up in a browser or that I can move on a IIS web server or an Apache web server somewhere that others can get access to. So that would be one of my suggestions to folks as they're considering their scripting languages is, think of something forward-thinking. You're never going to go wrong probably with VBScript or something like that you know is going to have some longevity to it.
Awesome. Yeah, I definitely agree. My duct tape that I call it of choice has been Python recently.
Mm-hmm.
It's really, I think it's an awesome scripting language. There's a lot of help out there for it.
Yep.
And it's so, like, I wrote a script in maybe five lines of code that in Java would have taken me, you know, a lot more. So I think I agree with you in your approach. Go with some sort of scripting language probably for these types of things, and you probably have less code and it'll be a lot quicker to write and get up and running.
It will be, and what I love about it is when these libraries become somewhat portable, as I'm porting some of my VBScript over into Lua, there were a few challenges along the way, but overall, I had a great structure in my core function library, and that really moved over very easily into another language. A lot of these scripting languages, there's nothing new under the sun, so they're probably doing 90% of the things very similar to one another. And then those oddball things are probably the things you're going to have to work through the most.
So, Greg, best way to contact you?
Oh, I'm easy to find online. Just Google Greg Pascal. That's GREGPASKAL. And Google, you're going to find me all over the web. Or you can just send me an email at greg@gregpascal.com.
I'll have the links to this and everything of value that we talked about in the show notes at www.testtalks.com/19. And as always, test everything and keep the good. Cheers.
Thanks for listening to the Test Talks podcast. Head on over to www.testtalks.com for full show notes, amazing blog articles, and other automation awesomeness.